Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to a brand new Arseblog Arsecast right here on arseblog.com. How are you? Hope you're well. Hope all is good with you and yours. I'm all right. It's another week into the transfer window, another week into the off-season, and another week in which Arsenal haven't done anything yet. Dominoes have yet to start falling. The market hasn't really begun to start moving yet. But there's time. There is time, of course. But given how much there is to do this summer, you'd like to think that, you know, something will happen soon. I'm keeping fingers crossed that something will happen soon. The transfer market and how it operates, how it works from a journalist's point of view is something that will be up for discussion with my first guest now in a few minutes' time. That's Charles Watts from Goal. We'll talk about a few of the bits and pieces that have been going on this week and transfer rumors, information, where it comes from, how reliable it is, etc., etc. That will be up for discussion in a little bit. As well as that, after Charles, I'll be chatting to George Bird, who is the man who knows everything there is to know about the Arsenal youth, the under-23s. It comes in the wake of Steve Bould's departure this week, so I'll be talking to him about what's going on there, what he expects to happen this summer, who are some of the up-and-coming names at that level that we should be looking out for, and more. So that's all in this week's show. Euro 2020, except in 2021, has been quite good fun this week. I suppose it depends entirely on your nationality. Like, if you're English, you'll be happy. If you're Portuguese, if you're German, if you're Swedish, happy, happy, happy. If you're Polish, Slovakian, Turkey, it's not been as much fun for you guys. But as a neutral, I've really quite enjoyed this week. I thought the last 30 minutes between Poland and Sweden was about the most exciting 30 minutes of the tournament so far. It was really great end-to-end stuff. I know it didn't end well for our Polish friends, and there are many of you listening. Sorry about that, but we've lots of Swedish friends too who will be quite happy with how that went. But it was really great. Just from a pure footballing perspective, it was very, very enjoyable indeed. A lot going on, of course. The knockout rounds are now completed. We know who's playing who. England versus Germany. That's a bit tasty, isn't it? And Bukayo Saka, well, he really stood out against the Czech Republic. He wasn't expected to start. There was the COVID issue for Mason Mount, and that may well have opened the door for him. But he really took his chance against the Czech Republic, played really well. And it was good to see an Arsenal player contribute positively in the tournament. There hasn't been a great deal of Arsenal interest during Euro 2020, except in 2021, because, well, we just don't have very many players there. Kieran Tierney's gone home. Granit Xhaka's still in it. Bernd Leno, of course, is the backup goalkeeper for Germany. And unless something happens to Manuel Neuer, he is not going to play. So we take our Arsenal bits and pieces where we can get them. Will Saka keep his place for that game against Germany? I would certainly pick him, but then I am not Gareth Southgate. The main difference between the two of us, of course, is that I can take a decent penalty. Too soon? Sorry. Anyway, look, who knows what will happen in that England versus Germany game and in the first knockout round of games which take place over the weekend. Right, let's get on with the show. And as I mentioned earlier, my guest first is Charles Watts from Goal to talk about Saka, Saliba, the transfer market, and much more. Hello, Charles.
Hi, Andrew, mate. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. We should talk a little bit about Bukayo Saka, I think, after the week he's had. A man-of-the-match performance for England during the week against the Czech Republic. Like, for Arsenal fans, that's not a surprise. We know what he can do. Were you maybe a little bit surprised that his quality has been a surprise to some of the wider football watching community, if you like.
Yeah, I absolutely was. I think it kind of might say a little bit about how much people bother to take notice of Arsenal at the moment.
Yeah.
That few seem to have known exactly how good Bukayo was. I think it was just after the team news had been announced, I put a picture up of Saka, and I used to cover Reading. I've still got quite a few Reading fans who follow me on Twitter.
And yeah.
Quite a few Reading fans sort of replied to it saying he shouldn't even be in the squad, let alone in the team. And I was like, what? Are you mad? Have you not seen what I've been seeing for the last year? And it just made me realise how many people actually aren't watching Arsenal at the moment. Because he's just been absolutely brilliant, isn't he? And I was surprised. And it's interesting now that everyone's sort of woken up to exactly how good he is, and he's not been out of the headlines ever since he came off against the Czechs. So fair play to him. I love watching Bukayo. I love how he takes everything in his stride. Nothing fazes him. And it was, you know, he was under a lot of pressure on was it Tuesday night, Wednesday night, whatever it was, because there was such a clamour for Jadon Sancho to start. And then in the build-up to the game, he didn't start. Saka got the nod ahead of him, and everyone who wasn't an Arsenal fan thinking, why is he getting in ahead of Sancho, who scored all these goals, set up all these goals at Dortmund? So he's under a lot of pressure from the start to perform, and he goes out there and plays like that in the Euros at Wembley under that sort of pressure. He just, nothing fazes him. I've never, from the moment I watched him, saw him that start against Frankfurt in the Europa League, that first game when we were over in Germany, and he performed like that, scored the goal, set up a goal, scored the goal, came down and talked to us in the mix zone. There was about 20 of us, 25 of us over there, gathered round, and he was 17 at the time, coming out, and all the Arsenal press office before him saying, look, we're going to bring him out, just be gentle with him, you know, he's a kid, he's 17, he's never done anything like that before. And he just walks out, bang in the middle of us all, in this massive huddle. Normally, you know, experienced player sometimes gets a bit sort of threatened by it all and clams up, and he just took it all in his stride. He was brilliant, he told us so much, talked for ages, nothing fazes him. He's just an absolute machine, and I'm delighted to see him playing now so well for England as well as Arsenal.
There was some great stuff during the week from Freddie Ljungberg on the Coach's Voice, where he talked about Saka, and, you know, he was coaching him when he was a 15-year-old, and he got the job with the under-23s, and he basically insisted that he bring Saka with him to play and train for that team rather than the under-18s, which is sort of in the middle, and that would be the natural kind of progression for him. And it does really speak to his maturity as a player and a young man, that he can sort of, I'm not going to say skip levels, but it is a bit like a little genius in school going ahead a few years and going to college at the age of 14 or something like that. He is slightly or somewhat ahead of what would be normally expected for a player of his age, and he showed that again on Tuesday.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he's a 19-year-old kid, and he single-handedly carried Arsenal through last season for the most part. He got a little tired at the end, I think. His performance has dipped at the end, but that's perfectly understandable given what he put into that season and how much responsibility he had to take, because, you know, senior stars all around him weren't performing. And I did a piece before the Euros. I went back and I spoke to his football teacher at Greenford High School who coached him when he was like 11, 12 years old, when he went through, and he was already at Arsenal at that point. And, you know, that school absolutely worship him. They've got England shirts up with him signed up when you walk in there. They've got pictures of him, and they hold him as such a figure to look up to for all the students going through that school, because not just for what he's achieved on the football pitch, but for how he handled himself when he was at school. You know, he ended up getting 4A stars, A's, in his GCSEs all the time. He was working at Arsenal. One day a week, he was on day release at Hale End. And his teacher said he never once didn't do his homework, never fell behind, despite not being at school. He did everything exactly what was expected of him. And they just see him as an absolute model student. They love him there. And in all aspects of his life, from anyone you speak to, from when he was 11, 12, through to where he is now, he's worked with him at Arsenal. No one has got a bad word to say about him and the way he handles himself on and off the pitch. He's an absolute diamond by all accounts. And, you know, Arsenal very, very lucky. And everyone, like you said, Freddie and everyone at Hale End who's worked with him and helped develop him into this man and footballer at this age at 19 deserves an awful lot of credit for that.
Before the England squad was announced, there was a kind of sort of feeling that maybe it might be the best thing for Bukayo Saka after the season that he had, how much he played, I won't say how much responsibility was given to him, more than how much responsibility he took. throughout this, you know, what was a really difficult season, as we all know. We don't need to go over the ins and outs of that again. But, you know, he won the Player of the Year award from the official website, et cetera, et cetera. But there was a feeling that maybe the best thing for him would be to have a summer off, to recharge, rest, you know, get ready for the new season, et cetera, et cetera. And I think we could all see that. But do you feel like going away with England, being part of a big international tournament, doing what he did, for example, on Tuesday as well, maybe people weren't expecting him to get much playing time, but, you know, he made a big contribution to England's win, that would be more beneficial to him as a player than rest, if you know what I mean, that he can take those experiences and feel like a senior part of the England team or the England squad. And, you know, that's one of the things people have talked about. There isn't a great deal of Arsenal representation at the Euros. You know, is it not a good thing that the best players that we have go away and play with their countries, even if we would like to wrap them in cotton wool and make sure they're fit and ready for the start of the new season?
Yeah, I think it's absolutely a good thing. Look, we're our Arsenal hats on. We want Saka protected, yeah, and rested up and ready to go at the start of next season. But for him, for his development, for everything, like you said, for his development as a man, as a footballer, this will be absolutely huge for him. It'll be so beneficial in terms of his career, what it will give to his belief, his confidence, how he belongs. You know, I think it's absolutely going to be a good thing. And I know, you know, it's not going to ruin him for next season. I can't see why it would at all. I think he'll be fine. He'll get a longer break. He won't come back for the start of pre-season with Arsenal. He'll get a longer break and he'll be ready to go once he does get back. He might, you know, have to sit out the first couple of weeks of the season, perhaps. Hopefully not, but maybe.
Mm.
But he's a young kid. He's not someone who we've seen be injury prone yet or anything like that. So I don't see how it's going to be an issue. I think it's going to be a very, very good thing. I think belief wise, confidence wise, it's just going to take him up another level.
Sure.
And you know, hopefully it'll work to Arsenal's benefit next season, not him.
Speaking of rest and relaxation, Kieran Tierney gets to put his feet up, which I suppose is, you know, with all due respect to our Scottish pals, it's a good thing from an Arsenal perspective. Scotland obviously will be disappointed that they didn't make progress, but Tierney, particularly given the end of the season that he had, he got that injury, we thought he was going to be out for the rest of the season as Euros were in doubt, and then he comes back and he got a little injury while he was away with Scotland as well. You know, he is such a, or hopefully is going to be such a key part of the team next season that he is somebody who we can say, well, okay, it's good for him that he can go on holidays now. And I don't know, he strikes me as the kind who might have like an Alexis Sanchez holiday, you know, run up and down a volcano for 3 weeks when he's supposed to be resting. But, you know, if he can sort of recharge a little bit, it'll be a good thing.
Yeah, I'm having said all that about Saka, I'm certainly not going to cry about Scotland going out and Tierney getting a rest. But I think that's definitely a good thing for Arsenal, that he's not involved too much further in this tournament. I can't even imagine Tierney going on holiday. You can't see him over on the beaches in Portugal or Vegas or something like that, can you?
No, not really.
I don't know what a holiday for Tierney would be or consist of. I think it's really, that is definitely a good thing that Tierney can come back. I mean, he's got his contract, which should hopefully be announced and confirmed and signed in the, you know, pretty imminently. And so that's going to be a massive thing for Arsenal, getting him confirmed for another 5 years. I'd be stunned if he's not captain at least halfway into that new contract. Mm. I'd be very, very surprised. You know, he's a fabulous player. Injuries have been a bit of an issue. And so the longer he gets off this summer to rest and get ready for next season, the better, because Arsenal are certainly going to need him. We saw how different a side they were at the end of last season when Tierney got that injury and missed that the crucial sort of run in and came back and clearly wasn't 100% fit. So, I think while it's good to see Saka continue, like I said, I'm certainly not going to cry about Scotland. Yeah. Scotland heading home early as usual and Tierney getting his rest.
Oh, well, there speaks an Englishman right there for sure.
0-0 in their cup final.
Yeah, well, look, let's move on to a story that's doing the rounds this week, and that's William Saliba. And Arsenal are interested in bringing in a right-sided centre-half, and the implications of that for William Saliba seem more serious than for any other player that we have in our books. And you know, we are... We are speculating a little bit. There is information out there that maybe we're looking to loan him again, and he is considering what the future might hold for him at Arsenal. You know, if we do spend big on somebody like Ben White, obviously it's an impediment to him playing first team football unless somebody else goes, whether it's Rob Holding or Pablo Marie, and Saliba can fit in on the left hand side of the defense. But it does seem like that's going on. You know, what do you make of this situation overall? With regards to Saliba, it feels like there's something at least that we're not aware of in terms of how this is all playing out.
Yeah, it's a really difficult one, this. I mean, we obviously don't know all the ins and outs of it. Nothing's really ever emerged about a proper falling out, which is odd because someone somewhere usually finds out about these things and it emerges, and it's never really come out that there has been any sort of issue. You know, it's not like a Guendouzi incident, which you can sort of trace back to exactly why Matteo's been kind of frozen out the way he has, but you haven't really had that with Saliba. And I think there's a fair few reasons behind it. I think he's ultimately a real sort of victim of the regime change at Arsenal. I think he's kind of the guy who's going to fall through the cracks of that massive change. He was signed by Unai, he was signed by Rao, he was signed by Hoos, Farming, you know, all those people. You look back to that video, his social media video when he signed, that everyone loves. And that he produced and his team produced. You got Hoos Farmi on the plane, on the private jet with him coming over. You got Rao welcoming him in and dancing with his agent at Colney when the thing's being done. You know, they're all gone. And Unai's there and everyone else has come in. And it kind of feels to me like he might end up being the victim of the changes that have gone on. And he's kind of slid beneath the cracks or between the cracks a little bit. Obviously, Arteta's come in. He didn't fancy him last season. That was very, very clear. From what I've heard, he wasn't great in pre-season, and it looked pretty apparent that he wasn't ready for the Premier League, for Arsenal. The issue I have with that is, although he might not have been quite ready for the Premier League, I don't see why he wasn't ready for the Europa League. There's no way he wasn't good enough to play in those Europa League group stages, which at least then would have got him some competitive minutes, and we wouldn't be sitting here thinking, we haven't even seen him play 1 minute yet. I think they totally messed up the start of last season. You know, if he wasn't going to play, they had to get him a loan deal. For him to stay and basically waste 6 months playing with the under-23, that's no good for anyone. It's no good for Arsenal. It's no good for Saliba. It's no good for the kind of relationship between the club and him as well. It was that was a real disaster. Not getting him that loan move in the summer was awful. And I think that has caused a lot of issues as well behind the scenes. And, you know, does he feel completely undervalued by that? And it was interesting seeing him at Nice because he did perfectly well in Nice. And again, you sort of looked at how he performed at Ligue 1, which, albeit it's not the Premier League, again, you go back to thinking, well, if you can play that well in Ligue 1, there's no way you couldn't have played in the Europa League or the League Cup in that first half season while he was still at Arsenal. So clearly there's been some errors made there. I think White coming in is going to be an issue for him. When you talk to people at Arsenal about it, their sort of position hasn't changed. He's still seen it. It's always, look, he's coming back in pre-season. He's going to get his opportunity. Whether he's now looking at it, these people are looking at it and thinking, well, they're after White. This isn't good news. I could understand why he'd be pondering his future a little bit and looking elsewhere, because he doesn't want to come back and not play again. And it's just a tough situation. It almost comes back to the transfer itself. You know, who sanctioned that deal? Why was that deal done? If he's not ready, why are you spending £27, £30 million on a centre-back who, at that age, to be honest, when you look across the top leagues in Europe, how many top clubs have got an 18, 19 year old centre back playing week in, week out? And you're in the books, none of them really. It just doesn't really happen. There's obviously a couple of examples you can find, but it's very, very rare. So although we were very excited about that signing, it seemed like Arsenal were being pretty clever. Maybe now you look at it and think, again, as part of wider deals that summer, it's turned out to be a bit of a red herring and certainly hasn't worked out as we all hope for.
I mean, it sort of raises a question about, like, I'm not casting any aspersions on the quality of William Saliba. Certainly, he was really highly rated in France. But I do wonder, is there, you know, a possibility that you can sign a really good player at the wrong time or at too young an age? Like, I understand the idea, the concept of going, well, look, he's got all this potential, we'll get in before anybody else can really gazump us or before his price tag gets even higher. You know, I understand the rationale for that. But if you're a Premier League club, you're buying a kid at 18 years of age, you're loaning him back for 1 year. The second year, you think, well, he's not ready. He hasn't played enough. There were reasons, obviously, because there was injury. There was the pandemic. He didn't play for 6 months. Was he ready to come in and do it at Premier League level? No. You can make the argument as you have, and I agree that he could easily have played in the Europa League against the opposition that we played against. You know, maybe that would have given all of us a better understanding of where William Saliba was as a player. But I just wonder if, you know, you can buy a player too young. I mean, I'm thinking slightly different, obviously, but someone like Gerard Pique, who went to Manchester United, and, you know, they bought him around the same time we bought Fabregas. There was that idea that he's a young player who's going to be a really good talent in the future, but he didn't quite do it at United, went back to Barcelona and became a mainstay in one of the greatest teams that Europe has ever seen. So, you know, it might just be a case that as a deal, while there might have been some logic behind it, it was just a bad idea.
Yeah, absolutely. I think right, but it's easy to look at it like that in hindsight, isn't it? I think at the time we were all pretty excited about it because I think we've all been crying out for Arsenal to be trying to kind of follow the whole, I don't know, use Dortmund as an example. Mm. You know, that's the type of signing Dortmund would make, but then they'd throw him straight in the team and then they'd see him, you know, they'd give him the chance to progress and suddenly you've got a £40-50 million player on your hands like Dortmund do time and time again. And we were kind of hoping this was going to be that sort of thing. And for once, Arsenal had done something pretty smart in the transfer market. Ultimately, it hasn't worked out like that. And now you've got a potential of a £30 million player, £27 million player you're not even going to see play for Arsenal, which is just mad. And it's a tough one. I mean, I didn't see him loads in Ligue 1 last season, but his numbers were good. And again, you're kind of looking at it and thinking, is he really that much worse than Rob Holding or players like that? Why is he not going to get a look in at all next season? It's a weird one. And it's really tough. I wish I had sort of background info on some major falling out that kind of explains the absence completely. But like I said, I've just not ever heard it. And from the fact that it hasn't been reported elsewhere, it doesn't feel like anyone else has heard it either. And it's just a real mysterious situation because he's obviously not a dud. There's no way he's a dud because you don't have the reviews that he got beforehand. You don't, you know, and these are respected scouts who went over and brought it in. Like, if this was just an absolute row deal, then I wouldn't be overly surprised that it's absolutely tanked. But I know that Francis Cagayao was right involved in this, you know, and other very respected scouts at Arsenal were very involved in getting him and thought they'd brought up, you know, signed a real superstar, potential superstar. And so, yeah, there's so many, it's just a really baffling situation. And I'd love to see him in pre-season come in and have a really good go. Look, Arsenal might sign Ben White, they might not. I don't see ultimately why Ben White signing absolutely is it for Saliba, means the end for Saliba. Maybe he sees it as the end, which I'd be a bit disappointed in if he throws the towel in just because Ben White is signed. You know, come back and give it a go in pre-season. Try and impress. If you believe in yourself that much and you're good enough, then try come back here and impress. You've got the summer to do it. We've seen Matteo Guendouzi do that when he first arrived, when everyone thought he was going to play for the under-23s. He impressed from the start and got himself in the starting 11 for the first Premier League game of the season that summer. So there's no reason why Saliba can't do that if, as everyone's certainly telling me at Arsenal, he is going to be given the chance to prove himself. Mm. So the stories coming out about him potentially looking elsewhere, that's coming from Saliba's side. It's not coming from Arsenal's side, really. But if he is feeling like that and a decent offer arrives, then, you know, Arsenal potentially would have to look at it. I'd like to see him loan, have a season in the Premier League. If they're going to loan him again, I'd love to see him in the Premier League where we can actually really watch him week in, week out and really assess where he is in terms of playing in this country.
Yeah, you wouldn't blame him though, like if he was, you know, when you are a £28 million signing at 18, it does speak to A, your talent and potential and B, some measure of faith in you by the club who's bought you to shell out that kind of money. So if you're coming back and it's the third season, albeit with difficult circumstances because, as you say, managers have changed, head of football has changed, the COVID, the whole football landscape has changed, et cetera, et cetera. You know, if you were him, you would be thinking, well, they don't believe in me if they're going to go out and spend maybe twice, close to twice what they spent on me on a player from the Premier League. I do wonder as well what the ownership must think of this deal, this player, this outlay, this money that we spent on him, and it's basically not money down the drain yet, but we've not had any return on the pitch for that money. And whether or not they feel like that's part of Mikel Arteta's responsibility, or are they prepared to sort of say, well, what happened post-Arsenal wasn't great, it didn't work, we could compartmentalize it and put it into that category and just sort of go along with what the manager and the technical director want now, which, again, we're not 100% sure of what that is.
Yeah. Well, I think the fact that I think Raul leaving almost as soon as Tim Lewis came on board was a big clear example of what the board thought of those sort of deals that had been taking place under the previous regime. And Raul obviously got the finger was pointed firmly at Raul and what happened with that money and why it was spent badly. But I'd imagine there certainly must be conversations between the owners and Mikel in terms of what are you doing with this person that we've invested heavily in. But clearly, they're willing to back Mikel again. Mm. You know, I don't think Mikel could have complained if he'd have got the boot after the end of last season. I didn't expect it was going to happen, but if he did get fired up, he wouldn't really have had too many complaints after 2 8th place finishes in the Premier League. But they're clearly backing him. They've kept him in the job, and they're willing to invest big money again this summer, potentially in positions like the centre back, where they've already got plenty of them already. So, the players that Mikel's after and wants, they're clearly looking to try and sign, which suggests that they're willing to give him, they're willing to back him and they still believe in him. So I'm sure there must be question marks. And, at the end of the season, they must look down and go through the squad with Josh and Tim Lewis now and, Richard Garlick. They must go over with these players and development or lack of development. But clearly, Mikel's not getting too much of the blame for it at this point.
Mm. Let's move on to sort of the wider issue of transfers and what's going on. It feels pretty deliberately quiet from an Arsenal perspective at the moment, in that we're hearing some things, we're hearing some names, we're hearing vague reports about certain deals and certain players, but it doesn't feel like any of that information is leaking from inside Arsenal, if you like, and they're playing their hands very close to their chest. How are you finding this transfer window in that sense? Obviously, there are many, many ways of finding out information about transfers and potential deals and clubs' interest in players and stuff like that. But are you heartened or disheartened, or what do you take from the fact that Arsenal are being this quiet? Is that stuff beavering on in the background? They don't want to be distracted. They don't want to show their hand to anybody. Or is, the other fear, if you go far the other way, is like, well, there's nothing going on. I mean, I can't believe there's nothing going on, but nothing actually would surprise me with this football club.
No, I mean, there is stuff going on. I mean, Arsenal are never one to really shout from the rooftop when it comes to transfers. They're not a club that briefs extensively. You do, obviously, at times you get you talk to people and you can get a steer in the right direction when they want it to, but they're not one that brief from the rooftops, not like some other clubs that I know. So a lot of the information does come from elsewhere, but they're certainly working. There is stuff going on. They've obviously had a couple of bid rejected for two key targets. And from people that I've spoken to, I'm not just talking about Arsenal here, but there's certainly plenty of agents in the industry who are looking to get stuff done this summer. They say it's just one big, massive game of cat and mouse at the moment in the market. And I think you can see that by the fact barely anyone's done any deals. There's lots of talk, but barely anyone's done anything of any note really so far. And agents are just saying that because there's so little money, because no one has got anything at the moment, it's just a big game of cat and mouse, because you got the selling club who want to sell to bring in money because they've got no money elsewhere to then invest. And so they're obviously after as much as they can possibly get for the player. And then you got the buying club who want to buy for as little as possible. And so it's just it's just this big game of cat and mouse to see who's going to break first. And you've kind of seen that with Arsenal, with the Gonga, with White. The bids have gone in, they're rejected, and the talks are ongoing, but nothing's been agreed yet because no one's agreeing about the price. It's the same with Granit Xhaka. I mean, you look at Granit Xhaka deal, that is all pretty much just waiting to be done and dusted. But Roma still haven't hit what Arsenal want them to hit. And there's been talks for ages, there's been bids rejected, Arsenal know exactly what they want for Xhaka. Roma haven't hit it yet, and it hasn't moved. And it's so many players like that. Guendouzi with Marseille, those talks are ongoing. And again, it's, you know, behind the scenes, that's a done deal in terms of player and happy to go there. Marseille want him, Arsenal happy to sell him. But the price hasn't been hit yet. And everyone's holding out for the right price at the moment because they know how important money's going to be this summer because there's so little of it around.
Is it a case of, you know, what you, like you set a benchmark perhaps? So maybe the first player as a club that you sell becomes the benchmark for other deals that you might want to do. Do you think that's it? Or is there a case of like, well, if one domino goes, the rest will go? Or you know, how is it? I understand, like, financially, it is difficult for all the clubs. Arsenal want to sell high and buy cheap. Everyone does, but that's not quite how it's going to work. At what point do clubs decide, okay, we're going to compromise? Or you know, is there a danger in inverted commas, like that this window, more than any other, could become a huge scramble in the last few weeks? And we should point out that this year, the transfer window is open until August 31st. It's not closing before the season starts. So there is the danger of your squad not being anywhere near as settled as you might like for the opening games, the opening weeks of the season.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a big danger of that. I mean, it always happens, doesn't it? No matter how much you say, oh, we don't want to scramble right at the end of the window, it always turns into a scramble. It's just, I mean, I think Mikel spoke about it before the end of last season. He was asked one question, do you want to get everything done early? And he said, well, of course I do, but it's just not going to happen. He kind of knows it. Everyone in football knows it. It always ends up in this big scramble. I think with Arsenal, there's so much that needs to be done. You kind of feel like it has to start soon. It needs to start getting done because, in fact, there's so much in terms of outgoings, incomings, contracts. You kind of felt like something should have happened early on. And it's maybe if granted that deal with Roma had been done early and they had agreed a fee before the Euros started, then it would have really sort of kicked things into life a bit. That didn't happen. And then Euros has further complicated things. You look at a goalkeeper situation at Arsenal, for example. I always use this as a prime example of just how much work Arsenal have got to do. Because you've got the situation with Bernd Leno, where you don't know what's happening with him. 2 years left on his contract. He's clearly open to a move. Arsenal, from what I hear, would be open to selling Bernd Leno. He's away at the Euros, though. Nothing's going to happen until we come back. Arsenal aren't in a position to go out and sign a keeper that they're interested in. Like Andre Onana at Ajax, they're interested in him. Aaron Ramsdale, they're interested in him. But they can't go out and sign one of those players, I don't think, before you either know exactly what's happening with Leno. Because you can't end up starting the season having got one of those in and then suddenly Leno stays and you're stuck with those two goalkeepers with no European football to offer either. So it's just not, they can't afford it for a start and they can't give anyone else some game time. So it's a really complicated situation because you want to bring someone in potentially, but you've got to move Leno on first. Meanwhile, you've got the second choice goalkeeper who you have to try and sign, which you haven't got yet because Runnison's clearly, well, rubbish. And and you want to try and sign Matt Ryan. You want to bring him back, but you can't offer him first-team football. Other clubs want to sign him and are offering him first-team football. Your third-choice goalkeeper, probably your third-choice goalkeeper, Arthur Okonkwo, is out of contract. And although that's going, from what I'm told, pretty well and they're hopeful he's going to sign, it's not done yet. So you basically got, you haven't got a clue who your first-choice goalkeeper is going to be. You haven't got a second-choice goalkeeper and your third-choice keeper is out of contract. I mean, that is enough to keep Edu busy for the next few weeks, let alone the entire rest of the squad that you've got to deal with. It's just mad. There's so much going on. I mean, Emil Smith-Rowe, the fact that Villa are even emboldened enough to bid for Emil Smith-Rowe is a warning sign in itself. Now, everyone tells me at Arsenal, look, we are not selling Emil Smith-Rowe. It's not going to happen, whatever they bid. But the fact that Villa actually believe they have a chance is a warning sign and is, you know, you've got to get that contract sorted out ASAP. It should have been done at the end of last season, really, straight away. They should have got that deal done. And it's just, they're spinning plates, Garlick and Edu, absolutely spinning plates. And at some point, they've got to say, right, let's get this sorted now and start moving forward. Because at the moment, I would be lost if I was them and I sort of stood in their office, looked around on their notice boards and their pin-up boards of the to-do lists they've got around there. I wouldn't have a clue where to start.
It's like that that scene from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia where they're standing and they're doing like that crime scene. They've got photos and stuff going everywhere, bits of string and what have you. I mean, the Smith-Rowe thing, I mean, if Villa feel emboldened to make a bid, you know, they look at Arsenal as a club, like going back to Saliba, who didn't get the Saliba thing done. So maybe there's an opportunity there to try and do something like that. And there is so much going on. How much impact do you think Richard Garlick is going to have in terms of easing the burden on Edu, who has made himself the point of contact for all transfer business at Arsenal? There's a committee, as we know. Mikel Arteta is involved. Per Mertesacker, I think, is involved. Richard Garlick has to be involved because he's going to be dealing with the legalities of situations like that. Does that give us some hope that, at least in terms of load management, there is something going on there in a positive way?
Well, you'd hope so. I'm told he's settled in well and he's impressed a lot of people in what he's doing. But yeah, you would hope it's certainly going to lessen the burden on Edu. They needed to get someone in once Hoos left, and they've got in an experienced guy who knows his stuff and has settled in well, from what I'm told. So yeah, it should do. But you know, it's not really something to celebrate, because Arsenal should need that person anyway. They can't. Yeah. They shouldn't just have Edu. Who, let's face it, is still learning on the job, looking after contracts as well as going out and signing players and bringing and selling players. It's just too much for one person, inexperienced person, to do. So they needed someone in, and hopefully Garlick will help with that. And they got the Tierney deal done, you know, which is a good thing. And
yeah.
You know, once that's confirmed and, you know, totally 100% finalised, then you would hope they would move straight on to Smith Rowe and get that sorted, because he deserves it. He needs rewarded for what he did last season. And you don't want to get into a situation like you did with Saka and end up those nervy times when he's down to the final year and suddenly you're really facing up to the prospect of potentially losing him, especially to a club like Aston Villa, with all due respect. I mean, can you imagine if you went to Aston Villa? To be an absolute horror show for Arsenal.
So it would be, yeah. Disaster.
They've got to get that sorted.
Yeah, it should be one of the easiest things they've got to do this summer. You know, in terms of contracts and players moving and players coming in, those things are difficult. But getting a 20-year-old who's come through the academy to sign a new deal, a lucrative new deal, to be part of a rebuild of the football club, really shouldn't be that difficult. So fingers crossed.
Who's playing week in, week out.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
As well. I mean, it should be an absolute given. That's why I just feel it. You know, they've taken their eye off the ball a little bit on that one. He should have got that straight as soon as that contract, the season was finished last season. It should have been the first thing, top of the agenda. Get it done, move on, and not get into the situation where you suddenly got into now.
Yeah, brand new number as well for him, hopefully next season as well, with that new contract. Just going back to transfers, and when you're digging around, when you're trying to find out information about a transfer deal, I'm not necessarily talking about Arsenal here specifically, but obviously that's a big part of what you do. Speaking to agents is a part of how you uncover information and what have you. When you speak to agents, you know, you're getting one particular side of something. You know, how important is it for you when you get a bit of information, let's say from that side, that you apply critical thinking to that? Like, you know, you can't take everything at face value just because an agent tells you something. You know, there might be, look, he's looking after his client, he's looking after himself. Those things might be at odds with, you know, a club's outlook on something like that. So how is that something that you deal with? I mean, are there some that are more trustworthy than others that you think, well, this guy's not going to lead me down a garden path, or others who you go, ooh, I'm taking that with a big pinch of salt? How does that work for you?
Yeah, it's crucial. Absolutely crucial. I think a lot of it depends on your relationship with the agent. Like you said, you kind of know how much you can trust someone or not, or how much sort of legitimacy you can put on what they're saying. And you've got to use your experience as well in this situation. And you can't just go out and splashing out, putting stuff out there which has just come from one person who maybe you don't know very well and clearly has an agenda. There's one prime example of this that I can't really go too much into, that but I had someone that I'd never really spoken too much before come to me with something earlier on in the window. Actually, it wasn't even earlier on in the window, it was before the end of last season, with something that, you know, told me a lot of stuff about it, and I was looking at it and I was just thinking, this doesn't feel right to me, or I'm not going to run this. And I left it, you know, I kept in touch with the person. I left it and I sort of continued to see how it sort of bubbled along. But this person clearly went to someone else in the industry who ran the story like there and then, clearly hadn't sort of double sourced it or anything like that, and ran the story, went pretty hard on it. And, you know, obviously it's nothing happened of it. It's not come to fruition at all. And I was talking to some other people that I know, other journalists I know, about this a few days ago. And it was just a prime example of one sort of using your head and your sense, your journalistic sense of like, no, this one just doesn't feel right. It feels like it's someone trying to get someone's name out there and really bring sort of publicity, because everyone wants their players linked with Arsenal. I mean, it's huge. One person in our Arsenal pack, the journalist pack, runs a story about someone, then it just gets picked up, especially in the media now. It gets picked up absolutely everywhere. You know, every single website runs it. It just gets turned around, and suddenly that player's name is everywhere. So you can see why agents want it. But yeah, you can't just go around this putting a story out on absolutely everything you get told. Far from it. You need to double source it. You need to look at elsewhere. Sort of use your brain really to work out if it's really one that feels right. And so yeah, it's one that I think sort of younger journos possibly. They get something, they'll be quite keen to rush it out straight away. But I think as you get older and you learn how agents work, and you get a little bit wiser to it all.
Yeah, again, just speaking very generally here, you know, I don't want to go into specifics about, you know, names or anything like that. But how much does who you're working for have an impact on how you can operate, if you know what I mean? So it strikes me that you know, at goal, you're not under massive pressure to come out with 3 or 4 transfer stories every day, whereas there might be people working at certain publications who are under that kind of pressure, who are, because they're perhaps a bit more driven by traffic and the need for clicks and things like that, have to sort of, I won't say compromise their principles in any way, but they are, the job demands that they file copy, and that can itself bring a certain amount of pressure, or maybe force you into doing or running a story that you might not otherwise if you had a bit more time or a lot less pressure on you.
Yeah, I think that's certainly that will certainly come into it. If you're a correspondent, you know, you're a specific club correspondent, it's slightly a little bit different, but maybe you're on a desk, you're just working on a desk job, and you've got, you know, you're doing a shift or something like that, and you get a lot of pressure to turn things around, get as many stories out as you possibly can. You know, there are some places that do that and put pressure on people, and, you know, you'll look at, they'll set targets in terms of page views and story counts and everything like that. And it's just an awful thing to do. It's an awful thing to do. And, you know, I've been in jobs before where the pressure is on when you're sort of looking at exactly how many people are reading your stories all the time. And it kind of takes over, and it puts so much pressure on you. You feel guilty if you're not helping out and stuff like that. Unfortunately, obviously, I don't have that goal, but you can get into that situation. And again, I think it's all about your experience and your age, and when you're in a position and you've been doing it for a long time, you don't have that sort of pressure, because you can kind of tell your boss that you're not going to be doing that. And you don't want your sort of integrity questioned as a journalist. And it's a worse thing to be putting stuff out there all the time and it not happening, and it just makes yourself look stupid ultimately. And then ultimately it makes the place you're working for look stupid as well. So yeah, it can be difficult. I think as a youngster in the game, especially nowadays with, how online media works, that you can be under that sort of pressure. You can have people above you, you know, demanding you do certain things, and they'll flag up stories that are elsewhere and saying, you know, do something on this, what can you do on this, and you feel the pressure to do something then just for the sake of it, rather than the fact that it's correct and you know it's correct. So again, it's just something I think you learn as you get older and you get wiser, especially in this new media industry that we all work in, that that you've got to make sure you're correct, because ultimately it's not going to do you any good, and it's not going to do your site any good if you're just putting out rubbish that doesn't turn out to be true.
Yeah,
most of the time.
Yeah, I mean, and the landscape of transfers and the actual transfer industry itself lends itself in some ways to to misinformation being valuable, if you know what I mean, that you can always say, well, it was 99% done and then it fell apart. And that happens a lot. It does happen a lot with deals that they're very, very close and all the information is given in good faith. But at the end, there can be a snag. There can be a hitch of some kind that means the deal doesn't get done. And it's, you know, I think it's in some ways it allows the spoofers, the kind of fake ITK people, it gives them an out. And at the same time, rather unfortunately, it can reflect badly on a journalist or a reporter who has, throughout the entire story, provided information in good faith.
Yeah. I mean, and it's like anything you're buying, it can go wrong, can't it? At the very last, like you're buying a house, you're buying a car, you're buying a bike, anything can happen. You know, that deal is done. And then right at the last, something happens, someone changes their mind and the plug is pulled. I mean, Nabil Fekir was at Anfield holding up a Liverpool shirt, and that never happened. That never got done. You know, he got to that stage and it fell through. So that just shows anything can happen at any point that can affect the deal. And then, yeah, suddenly as a journalist, you can, especially with social media nowadays, you know, you can get destroyed over it, really, for something that's not even your fault. It's not your fault the deal breaks down. You've reported on something that's absolutely spot on the whole way through, and then just because a deal doesn't get done, somehow it's your fault and you were talking rubbish and it wasn't true when it absolutely was. And it's one of the things I hate about social media is almost now your quality as a journalist is almost judged on transfers, and I hate that with an absolute passion, because transfers is not, I mean, it's a part of football, but it's not the most important part of football. The most important part of football is football. Not about who signs who and who got what first. I mean, one journalist in the world can break a story each time, you know, can be the first person to report on something that is in an interest or something like that. And then, you know, it's very hard to get that. So hard to be the very first person, especially if you're based in one country and the deal's happening elsewhere in another part of the country. And yet you're sort of ranked. I hate this whole tier system of, oh, he's a tier one journalist, he's a tier two source, all that stuff. It's such rubbish. It's like, you've got some of the best journalists that I know are sort of considered tier five journalists, which is utter bollocks, to be fair, because they're fantastic journalists who are brilliant. And somehow I'm like, in these charts that I see, I'm up at like tier one or tier two, which I look at and I just think it's, you know, I would dream of being as good a journalist as some of these guys who are down ranked as tier five and tier four and being able to write like them and tell stories like them and everything like, you know, I dream of that. And yet, a lot of people hold me in higher esteem than them because I said Arsenal were making a move for Thomas Partey on transfer deadline day or something like that. And it's just, the whole transfer thing is, oh, I hate it. I was talking to, you know, Lewis Ambrose.
Yeah.
I was talking to him about it the other day, and he said, I would love to fast forward to the first weekend after the transfer window is shut and just cut all this bullshit out now. And not have to worry, because it puts, you know, as a journalist, I feel totally under pressure during the window to try and get stuff and to, you know, to a service work and, you know, make it look like I'm doing what I am doing.
Yeah.
But also to, you know, get so many questions about everything and, you know, constant. And I want to keep people updated, but most of the time there's nothing to say. It's like the Andre and Arna story, for example. I get the amount of questions I get every day of like, what's happening with that? What's happening with that? It's like, well, nothing's happening with that. Nothing since I last reported on it. Nothing's changed. If I knew something had happened, I would report it, but nothing has happened. And it's almost that demand for every single bit to be updated every single day when there is nothing to update. And it's a difficult time, I find, as a journalist. And like I was saying at Lewis, I would love nothing more just to fast forward each summer, get to the start of the season, transfer window be shut, know exactly who we've got, who we haven't got, and then just concentrate on football. It would be a hell of a lot less stressful in terms of my job anyway.
No, I'm sure. And for everybody, I think if we could just, you know, go into a little hibernation for the summer or go on holidays, put your feet up, lie in a hammock and drink cocktails for a few months and then come back and everything is sorted. It is this clamor, this desire for information is really, it's huge, isn't it? And it just struck me, like when you were talking about the Onana thing there, that like stuff happens and then quite often nothing happens for ages. It's not like there are negotiators in rooms 24/7, you know, thrashing out deals here, there and everywhere. You know, quite often communication, it goes dark even when there is you know, interest in a player or a deal to be done for long periods, nothing can happen for various reasons.
Well, look at Thomas Partey last season. That went to deadline day, yet the interest was there the entire summer. Well, dating back well before the entire summer, and yet it didn't happen until deadline day. And all that needed was the release clause to be hit, and yet they waited the entire summer. Yeah. So, you know, it just doesn't all happen quickly. And I think everyone's so determined for signings to be made a week after the window opens that when it doesn't happen, it just builds up and builds up, and frustration builds up. You'll see another club sign someone, then suddenly that frustration increases even more. And yeah, I mean, to be fair, I can't, before I started this job and before I remember like 10 years ago when I was working on my local paper down here in Maidenhead, and I'd sit in the newsroom trying to get the back page done on Maidenhead United all the time while having Twitter up, having a right go that Arsenal hadn't signed Yann and Villa. And so I can't say it too much because I was in the same situation 10 years ago before I was actually doing this job, and I was getting as angry as everyone else that we hadn't signed those sort of players. Getting excited that Cazorla was signing and wanting to know more about when he was coming over from Malaga and stuff like that. So I can understand it. But yeah, I think now I'm actually in this seat and I'm doing it. It's the sort of balls on the other foot, and I can see why for journalists it's a difficult time.
Yeah, well, look, I look forward to you breaking the long-awaited signing of Solomon Kalou this summer, Charles. Stay.
He's a free agent this summer.
Perfect. Well, look, stay as sane as you can. Keep up the good work, and it was great to talk to you. Thanks a million.
Top man. Cheers, Andrew.
Thank you very much indeed to Charles. You can find him on Twitter at Charles_Watts. That is at Charles_Watts, and he writes about Arsenal and other things for Goal.com.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's a brand new year, and what better time to get going with that online store you've been thinking of? Those "I was there when Arsenal actually scored a goal" t-shirts would fly off the shelves right now. And to get yourself up and running, you need Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way through to the did we hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms, and sell more with less effort with thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 a month trial period at shopify.com/arsblog, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/arsblog now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/arsblog. Now, there is a lot going on at every level of the club this summer. The men's team, the women's team, and at youth/under-23 level. Steve Bold is gone. This week, the club advertised for a new head coach for the under-23s. I'm not sure if this is something that they have to do, if they're legally obliged to do that, or if it's because, well, they're struggling to find the right candidate. Nevertheless, plenty to do, lots to talk about, and with me to do that, the man who knows all there is to know about Arsenal at this level, it's George Bird. Hi, George.
Hi.
Steve Bold's departure was announced this week. It's bringing an end to his 33-year time at the club. As a coach, he won the FA Youth Cup. He worked with Arsene Wenger. He worked with the Unai Emery setup, moved back down to work with the under-23s again. It wasn't particularly good last season. I think there were reasons for that we might come to. But how would you sum up his time and his work at the club as a coach?
Well, firstly, he had good pedigree as a coach at youth level. from his spell in charge of the under-18s. Mm-hmm. He coached like the likes of Cesc Fabregas, Jack Wilshere, etc. And he had a good reputation. But since he became under-23 coach, I think he did okay in his first season. He helped to develop the likes of Balogun and John Jules. But then last season, as everyone knows, the results weren't very good. Some of his selections were a bit puzzling, but you don't know like whether he was told to play certain players sometimes. I don't know, it's a difficult one because like he's such a prominent figure like at Arsenal, but I think there were times where maybe he could have given players like more freedom tactically last season. But I actually didn't expect him to get sacked because we've had seasons at youth level before where the results haven't been that great and then the coaches still kept their job. But I think Mertesacker is just trying to probably move things forward and try and get somebody who's a bit younger and is trying to play like free-flowing football. But it's disappointing to see Bold go, especially because he's had like such a long association with the club.
How difficult was it for him last season? Because there was this strange sort of gap, wasn't there, in that like there was this generation of young players that have come through and made it to the fringes of the first team and sort of become first team players. And you can look at Saka, Smith Rowe, Willock, Maitland Niles, Nketiah, et cetera, et cetera. And it felt a little bit like last summer there was a gap in terms of numbers because a lot of players went out on loan. And then there was an age gap as well, wasn't there? The next generation wasn't quite ready. So the club went on this quite strange recruitment drive, bringing in players maybe who hadn't quite made it elsewhere. Maybe they were taking a gamble on some young talent who perhaps didn't get a chance somewhere else and could flourish at Arsenal and what have you. But it doesn't seem like those players have worked out quite the way they would have liked. So there was a little bit for him to deal with in terms of the players he had available to him.
Yeah, it was very difficult circumstances. As you said, we loaned out a lot of players and I think most of them were centre-backs as well, so we were quite short in that area. And as you said, the players that were brought in, they were like really unusual signings, the likes of Dinzey, Akinola and George Lewis. They didn't really... Akinola played a lot of games, but none of them really made a major impact. And I think most of them are going to be sent out on loan next season, so they're probably unlikely to make it at Arsenal, so they're basically just stopgaps. So that may have contributed a bit to the results. And also, there are times when there were like FA Youth Cup games around the same time I'd done 23 games. So like key players like Aziz, etc., like sometimes missed out on the under-23s, and that had an impact on the results as well.
What is the state of play with regards to a replacement for Steve Bold? Are you aware of any names that are in the hat? Are they looking internally or externally for a replacement?
Well, the reports like this week suggested that Kevin Betsy is under consideration. He's coached like various England youth teams, and he knows like quite a few of the Arsenal youth players as well. And I think he's like got a reputation for being a like modern coach with a progressive style, so that could be something that works well, but a decision hadn't been made yet. But they're due back in training in like a couple of weeks, so I think something should happen very quickly.
We have a question from the Discord, our Discord for Patreon members, and Othman wants to know, what do you think of Per Mertesacker's implementation of his vision for the club? Because he's a man who's obviously got some ideas about what way he wants the players to be brought up and be educated at Arsenal, you know, as footballers and as people too. You know, how much alignment is there with, you know, what he wants, what Mikel Arteta wants? Is there a sort of symbiosis there in some ways? Are they working together to build the academy here? And is the departure of someone like Steve Bold, for example, a natural consequence of trying to put something new in place?
Yes, I think so. I think Arteta and Mertesacker work quite closely together. And also, Arteta often invites like a lot of under-23s to train with the first team. But I think he's still like, even though he's been there quite a long time, it's still too early to judge Mertesacker properly because you need to wait a few more years for that. But he does have like very clear ideas, and I think he's trying to, in a way, like imitate Chelsea's policy of like loaning out a lot of players every year and then selling some of them, and then just the best ones getting to the first team. But we can still possibly make money from other ones. But yeah, as you said, there's a very like there's a huge emphasis on like how players act off the pitch. He just doesn't really accept it if people like, aren't disciplined. There was one incident last season where a player was involved in a disciplinary incident and then he got dropped from the matchday squad like straight away. So, but I think he knows what he wants to do. But there are times when you can see he's like a bit inexperienced at times because with like, for example, the players that he brought in last year. But I think he does know what he's doing. He's got a strong like, philosophy, but we still have to wait like a few more years to judge him properly.
Yeah, it does take time, doesn't it, to build something at a academy level and youth level. And, you know, this week we saw the departure of, you know, three fairly well-known youth players, Mark McGuinness, Trey Coyle and Zach Medley, who have all left the club. And this idea that we might, you know, use the academy to develop players, send them out on loan. Maybe they don't make it with us, but we can get some money in for them. You know, maybe we've got some distance to go just yet because those players have left on free transfers. And as far as I'm aware, or I was told that there are sell-on clauses, of course, in the deals there. So if they go and they develop and they command a fee in the future, we will benefit from that. But, you know, the level, I guess, has to become more consistently higher if you're going to sell players directly from your youth system.
Yeah, but I think the thing is with those players and like the other players who are in like their age group, a lot of them, they're quite good players, but I don't think most of them are going to make it anyway. So that's why we're seeing quite a lot of departures now. But I think the generation like after that, like the ones who are about 17 years old now, like Patino and Hutchinson and Norton Cuffey, they're the ones who, like some of them actually have a genuine chance of making a breakthrough. So it'll be interesting to see like whether that loan policy continues in a couple of years because you want to be like integrating some players into the first team as well. So it's going to be difficult to get a balance really. But I think next season, especially because we're not in Europe, I can't really see that many chances for youngsters. So I think most of them will go on loan.
Well, I was going to ask you about that because, you know, Arsenal don't want to be in the Europa League. We want to be in the Champions League. But if there is a sort of side benefit to being in the Europa League, it's the ability to use some of the younger players who aren't quite ready for first team football at Premier League level. You can use them in the Europa League. And again, coming back to the generation of Nketiah, Willock, Nelson, Maitland Niles, Smith Rowe, Saka, et cetera, you know, they really have benefited from playing Europa League football. They've, you know, got semi-regular first team appearances in a European competition, playing away from home in some big stadiums at times as well. And it's been a real benefit to them. And it's been a way for the club to sort of blood young talent to bring them through next season with no Europe at all. And with only 38 Premier League games, it becomes much more difficult for these guys to get chances. So there might be the Carabao Cup round two, which could be an opportunity for some of them for the first time in a long time are going into that competition at round two. But beyond that, you know, if you get a friendly draw in round three, round four, you know, you can use some of those players. But beyond that, it's hard to see them being, not trusted is the wrong word, but Mikel Arteta is going to have better players to choose from at Premier League level. So how do we then judge the performances of the under 23 team in the sense that if the best young players in order to develop them are going to be loaned out, that's going to have an impact on results. Do you feel maybe sometimes people look a bit too much at the results of the under 23 teams and think that things are poor when the reality is, you know, it is a developmental process for young players. It's not so much about results, but it's about how much playing time you can get these guys, where maybe you can send them on loan and how ready they are to make a step up as and when that happens.
Yeah, I think that's definitely the case. I think results aren't always important at youth level and development's like definitely the most important thing. But that said, like if you look at some of the best like academy graduates in recent years, like Coughlin and Wilshere played and won the FA Youth Cup and then they made a lot of appearances. And then the likes of Smith Rowe and Nketiah, Willock, they won the league with the under 23s and Saka finished second. So I think if you do have a lot of really talented players, then the results like will go well. But you can't like look into results too much, especially like at under 23s, it's always like a mix and match team of like some older players and first team players dropping down. So it's difficult. It's really hard to get consistency unless you have like a really special couple of players. But as I said before, I think we've got players like who are about 17 who are stepping into the under-23s now. So I actually think even if a lot of players are loaned out, then the under-23s could do like quite well next season.
What more are you expecting from the club at youth level in terms of players anyway? I mean, it feels like the departures this week are just kind of the start of what might be, I don't want to say a clear out, but it might be a case that in order to make room for the next crop, the next generation to come through, you do have to let some players go. So are you expecting more departures?
Yeah, I think so. But I think most of them will probably be on loan. They've already made like 8 players available for loan, like including like Moller, Cottrell, et cetera. So yeah, but I think there will be some permanent departures as well. There's quite a few like older youngsters like Dan Iliev's like 26, Taladi Bowler's 22, Georgi Ozitu's 22 as well. So they need to like move some of these players on. And Ben Sheaf's another one. But basically they've got way too many like academy players at the moment. So they have to get rid of some anyway, like even if they don't want to. So there will be a lot of departures, but I think it'll be mostly like loans with like most of the players who went on loan last season will probably like go on loan again, like John Jules and Ballard.
What about incoming deals? We do bring in players from other clubs and from abroad to bolster the ranks and to try and develop them into first team players. But the signings that we made last summer that we referenced earlier haven't really worked out. Do you think that's kind of it for that kind of process?
Yeah, possibly. I think there will be some players coming in, but there'll probably be players who actually have a like genuine chance of like getting into the first team. I mean, like last summer there were like the likes of Moller and Salah Adim, like different types of signings. They're actually like really talented players. So I think there could be like a couple of like interesting prospects being signed. There's one centre back from Peru who might train with Arsenal like this summer. So yeah, but I don't think they're going to be bringing in players like who got released by our clubs like last year.
Who are the standout prospects at youth level now? Who are the ones that might be, if we were to suffer an emergency tomorrow, who are the ones that are closest to the first team? Obviously, Balogun is a name that everybody is aware of, and he signed a new deal. And Miguel Aziz is a young midfielder who is very highly rated, lots of talent. And I suppose those are the two that if you were to ask people, they're probably closest. But beyond that, are there names, are there players who have the potential to sort of start knocking on the door a little bit? You know, players who, even if they're not necessarily going to play for the first team, might be involved regularly with first team training.
Well, Kiddo Taylor-Hart, a winger, is like a really talented player. He did very well for the under-23s last season, but the thing is, we don't know whether he'll still be at Arsenal next season because his contract like expires next week. But if he does stay, I think he will get opportunities eventually. And the other ones like are like 17 years old, really. Charlie Patino, a midfielder, is an excellent passer. I think he will get closer to the first team next season. I don't feel get any minutes, but they'll definitely give him a chance eventually. And Amari Hutchinson as well, he's a winger, but he can play at left back and attacking midfield. He's really skillful. And one more is Omar Rekic. He's a centre back. He's already a full Trinidad international, and we signed him earlier this year. He's struggled with injury, but he's a really talented player. And yeah,
we have a question from the Discord. Ash Richards 90 says, is there not a good fullback option in the reserves for both right back and left back? And obviously Arsenal this summer are looking for backup for Kieran Tierney, and the right back situation is a bit up in the air because we don't know what's happening with Hector Bellerin, with Cedric Suarez. Callum Chambers could be an option there, but there's talk that Arsenal need or want to sign a right back, I should say. What is there, or what might there have been at youth level? Joel Lopez was a left back that we brought in from Barcelona, but obviously not considered ready enough to deputise last season. Is he any closer to becoming a player that might be available for the first team, or how do you view the fullback situation?
Well, the thing is, we've got a lot of talented young right backs. We just lost one in Daniel Ogoki, but Brook Norton-Cuffey is a very good player, and Biosu has done quite well, but he might go on loan. But I don't think any of them are like quite ready to step up yet, but in the future they could be. At left back, there aren't hardly any options at all, really. Joel Lopez, there was a lot expected of him when he joined from Barcelona, but he hasn't really pushed on. His positioning is not that great. I think he needs to go on loan next season, but it'll be difficult for him to make it anyway. There are a couple of other like young left backs, but they're not ready yet. So I think if we want a backup left back, we've got to sign one probably. But at right back, Norton Cuffey might be ready to step up, even though he's only 17, because he's done really well.
Well, look, there's going to be plenty happening at a youth level across all levels of the club, actually, you know, from the men's team to the women's team to the youth team. People can get the latest updates from the Arsenal Youth and Under-23 setup, of course, on your site, Arsenal Youth, but also on Arsblog News, where you write columns for us frequently. But for now, George, we better leave it there. Thanks very much. That was George Bird. You can find him on Twitter at George Bird, at George Bird, George with a J and not a G. His site is arsenalyouth.wordpress.com, and he writes about the Arsenal Youth and Under-23s, etc. for Arsblog News. You can find him there. Right, that's kind of that. I suppose the one thing I should mention is at the time of recording, it is being reported that Arsenal and Brighton have reached an agreement over the signing of Ben White. A fee has been agreed. Apparently, behind the scenes, things have been done deal, personal terms, all that kind of stuff has been sorted out ages ago between the club and the player. It was all about the deal now. Some suggestion of $45 million plus another $5 million based on bonuses, appearances, that kind of stuff. It does look as if Ben White is edging ever closer to being an Arsenal player. We'll wait until the signing actually goes through, until we get into the nuts and bolts of it. But $50 million is a lot. $45 million plus five, whatever way you want to put it, is a lot of money to spend on a defender when really the defence is not the most pressing part of our rebuild this summer. So I suppose you can look at it in a couple of ways, I guess. One is that, you know, we're being really silly and we're spending a load of the transfer budget on a player that we don't really, really, really need. It's not to say that Ben White can't come in and be a good player for Arsenal, but how are we going to solve our creative issues? Are we spending a big chunk of our transfer budget on a defender? Another way of looking at this, and I guess it's very much a glass half full, and it's one of those where you'll believe it when you see it kind of situations, is that even though we are spending £50 million on a centre-half, we still have money to do the other stuff that we need to do, which is to buy a creative player, an attacking midfielder, as well as a central midfielder, at least one of those, to slot in alongside Thomas Partey, and maybe a couple of other things as well. So Arsenal as an institution have flummoxed me as much as they have you down the years, but I cannot believe that in a summer where we really need to prioritise the creative slash attacking side of the transfer market, we're going to spend all our money on a defender. I can't let myself believe that. Maybe it's true, maybe it's not. I just feel like even for us, that would be ridiculous. So I'm hoping that Ben White comes in and there is still money to spend on a number 10, on a central midfielder, maybe on a right back, etc., etc. I have to cling to that. It is perhaps something James and I can discuss in the next Arscast Extra. When is that, you say? I don't know. That's the bottom line. I don't know. It could be Sunday morning. It could be Sunday evening. It could be Monday morning. I don't quite know. James has got a busy schedule at the moment. We have yet to touch base about this weekend's recording, but we will have an Arscast Extra for you in the next couple of days. Maybe there will be more transfer developments by the time we get around to recording that one. So please do join us for that. The Euros are on over the weekend. Knockout football could be exciting, could be fun. So enjoy that. In the meantime, look after yourselves. Have a great weekend, and we will catch you on the next one. Thanks as always for being here. Hope you enjoyed the show. Take it easy, folks. Cheers. Bye-bye.
Look, man, it's
so easy to get your head around, right? I'm going to do the shopping. You got that part? Right, the shopping. I look in the fridge before I go. What have I got in the fridge? Potatoes. Pretty expensive potatoes too. Bought them a couple of years ago. Had to lend them back to the shopkeeper for a while, but now they're my potatoes. Potatoes with real promise. They could be anything they want to be. Chips, hash browns, mashed potatoes, roast potatoes, samosas, croquettes, baked potato. If they go all the way to the top, they could become bird's-eye potato waffles. So now, when I'm going to the supermarket and I've got me money, what am I going to buy? That's right. More potatoes. Even more expensive potatoes than the ones I've got already. Because you know what? You can never have too many fucking potatoes. Especially ones that are England internationals.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.